Hello, hello, and welcome back to Art House Garage, the snob-free film podcast where we make art house, indie, classic, and foreign cinema accessible to the masses. I'm your host, Andrew Sweatman, and today we are bringing you the season finale, looking at the film The Truth from Japanese director Hirokazu Koreeda. Over the last six episodes, we've been looking at contemporary Asian filmmakers, including Apichit Pong Wirasethakul from Thailand and Bong Joon-ho from Korea. It's been a good season of films, and today we are closing it out with another wonderful film, and Koreeda's first, that is not in his native Japanese language. I'm joined again by my friend and fellow film podcaster, Omaya Jones, the programmer of the Arkansas Times film series. Omaya, how are you, and what have you been watching?
I'm doing well. I have been watching mostly documentaries lately, so at the time that we're recording this, the Hot Springs Documentary Film Festival just ended, and I got to go to Hot Springs and see one thing.
Oh, cool.
In person.
They can drive through there. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. That film was called Ottolenghi and the Cakes of Versailles. And it's a sort of behind the scenes thing where they filmed various food people and their prep for one of the Met Galas that was, and the theme for that particular Met Gala was Versailles. And so there, you see all this really elaborate food prep and all this research into the history of the food and the time period. And there's just all this historical educational component to the film. Mm-hmm. And then other than that, I've watched a couple of other documentaries. One was David Byrne's American Utopia.
Oh, yeah.
Directed by Spike Lee, right? That was just on HBO.
It's on HBO now? I didn't realize that.
Yeah, it premiered at the time of this recording. It premiered last Saturday.
I've been meaning to watch that. Okay, wow.
And I enjoyed it a lot, except for a couple of spots where he played songs that were also featured in Stop Making Sense. But for the most part, it was really easy to not get lost in trying to compare the two.
Yeah.
And then I also watched, finally, The Way I See It.
Ah, yes.
Which, yeah.
Did you watch that on the MSNBC when it aired?
Right. So they aired it on MSNBC commercial free on Friday, I think. I've sort of like this mixed reaction to it.
Yeah.
Coming at it from both like as a film and the form of it. Mm-hmm. There's like this emotional pool. I was somewhat involved in the Obama campaign in 2008 at a local level. I volunteered, I knocked on doors. I was actually a delegate to the national convention. So I got to go to Denver
really?
And be a part of that process. And so like, there were a lot of these emotions that were just kind of being pulled out of me. And like the sense of like pride and getting to like relive that. But there is also just this this weird sense of sort of like watching it and knowing where our politics is today and sort of like what activism on the ground is like and just seeing how there's this sort of disconnect between, I don't know, like what this level of politics from the people who are like insiders versus like people on the ground.
Yeah. Pete Souza's activism is not congruent with that kind of activism, you mean? Like it's a different level or different kind of thing?
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, they make a great deal of the film, the fact that he's willing to use his voice.
Yeah.
But the way he uses it are these like snarky Instagram comments, you know?
Yeah.
And so it's presented like the idea that's like, this is it's a big deal that someone would go on Instagram and, make sassy comments, but like day to day, like reality, it doesn't seem like it's that big a deal.
Yeah. You know? Is it more of just like an echo chamber kind of thing? Yeah. Like people who like it, of course they like it, and people who don't aren't going to hear it or pay attention. Yeah. I think that's valid. That makes a lot of sense. I really liked it. So I saw it at the drive-in at Filmland, and it was surprisingly emotional. If you told me, you know, a photography documentary was going to make me cry, I would have been surprised by that, but it definitely did. And some of that is just the disparity, which I think that's what it lays on really thick, is look how the Obama years were and look at what we have today. And it definitely just makes you miss that. And I think And they obviously wanted it to come out right before the election to try to sway people. But maybe you're right that it's the same kind of thing that people who love Obama, they're going to love this. But people who are on the other side of things, is this really going to convince anyone? I don't know. That's an interesting question.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say, I think it's worth watching. I just, like, I wonder if it, if the film actually has the bite that I, that it thinks
that it,
does.
Wants it to have. Yeah.
Yeah.
I liked on the level to, I don't want to talk too much about this because I'm actually hoping to do a whole episode on it, in a few weeks, but, just the photography aspect of it, like it was just fascinating to see like what his job was like. And then the way he talked about trying to capture a story in a still image for someone who's not a photographer, that was really fascinating. I'm sure that, I don't know, I have a couple of photographer friends. I want them to see it and see their take on that aspect of it. But I enjoyed that.
What have you been watching?
Yes. I was just going to talk about one thing. Well, I guess I can list a few things. I watched Dick Johnson is Dead, which we're going to hopefully discuss in the future as well. I also watched a film called... I won't go into much detail on Dick Johnson is Dead because that'll be, again, the focus of more discussion. I watched The Assistant, which is a film directed by, looking up her name right now, Kitty Green. And it stars Julia Garner, who I know from Ozark. She's a really great actor. She basically, she plays a low-level assistant at a company where like a Harvey Weinstein type of person is the boss. And like it pretty clearly kind of mirrors that. But it's the style of it is really great. It's kind of really minimal and quiet. And so then when the heavy things happen, it like really hits hard because it's such an understated kind of a movie. I'm also planning to discuss that one on a later episode. So I'll also hold back some of my thoughts there. But I do recommend that one. And then the one that I really want to talk about is, have you seen the Watchmen series from last year?
I have seen, I would say the last, how many episodes are there? Like
nine, I think.
Nine. So I've seen probably the last seven episodes.
But not the first two?
Yeah, I don't. So sometimes no when things are on TV, like cable or something.
Yeah.
So I grew up primarily in the 90s, you know, back then you didn't always watch television in order.
Yeah.
So that's a habit that I have continued to maintain. So, you know, I would just watch, like it was on, I would watch whatever episode was on. They aired a bunch of episodes back to back to back. I watched a few and that was kind of how I experienced Watchmen. I do the same thing with movies sometimes. If I turn on HBO and a movie that I want to see is on, I'll watch it from whatever point that I catch it to the end. And then later I'll go back and catch the beginning.
Interesting. Wow. That's different from me, but that, yeah, again, no judgment. That's really interesting. How were you familiar? Like, did you ever read the comic of Watchmen or see the film from 2008?
I've seen the film. I've read the comic. I actually have on my bookshelf, the Absolute Edition.
Nice.
Which is like an oversized version. So I've been familiar with Watchmen for a while. My undergrad, I was in sequential art, which is a fancy term for comics. Yeah. So I went to SCAD for that. So, Watchmen, I feel like is a big part of being a comic book fan of a certain age.
Yeah.
Especially if you're an American.
That's really interesting. I didn't know that about you. Wow. I read it in college and then saw the film, and didn't love the film, which I think is, you know, probably not unique, but, yeah, I really like the show a lot. I think the way it brings racial issues into the forefront, I did not expect. I mean, I kind of heard that going kind of before I watched it, but much more than I expected. Like, to give some idea, it opens with the Tulsa Massacre, which, if we actually, we can raise some awareness here because the Tulsa Massacre was this real event that happened in the 20s that in Tulsa, there's this really affluent black neighborhood that was decimated by the Klan, I think, or just blatantly racist things happening. And that was then covered up for years and only gained any public attention in the last like 10 years, I think. And so I thought it was really interesting that it decided to just open the show with that and depict what that was like. And then having Regina King at the center of the story. And I think that one of the fun things about this too is how it brings in, in some really surprising ways, brings in the history of the show, because at first it just seems like this might be a whole separate story. But I think that's some of the fun, is how it does connect back. So anyway, I really was into it. And yeah, really, really enjoyed it. Did you generally like it?
I want to go back and watch the first couple episodes. I feel like I have mixed feelings, and part of it comes from, I think, being a fan of the comic and having an idea of, there's like a whole convoluted history with the publication history of Watchmen and the rights of the characters and the story that has to do, nothing to do with the show and everything to do with like DC Comics and Alan Moore and contracts. So that's, it's kind of boring, but it's hard to like not bring that with you.
Sure.
That said, the show was interesting in that it does take, it doesn't just, you know, it's not just a straight adaptation.
Right? Yeah.
They play with it. And then listening to one of the writers who won an Emmy for it on Fresh Air talk about the way the writer's room worked, where is it named Lindelof?
Yes. From Lost and The Leftovers. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right. Like he kind of like assembled this writer's room, this really diverse writer's room, people of color, and then just kind of gave it over to them to like create this. Right. Cause it almost is like saying like, you know, this show is supposed to be about like you guys and your perspective and like letting them kind of just like run with it.
Wow.
And so delegating a lot of that power. And I was just thinking, you know, actually like picking things up in the middle and watching them is also kind of like if you grew up reading what we call floppies, single individuals of comics in the 90s. Because, you know, when I was growing up, you could go to like the grocery store and there'd be like a newsstand that had comic books on them. Mm-hmm. And you didn't necessarily start with X-Men number one. You know, like my first issue was probably like 260 something, you know?
Yeah.
And it's just so you just, you kind of, you learn to pick up the story in the middle of things and kind of just figure it out. Mm. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think it does a lot of, like, even Watchmen itself, like stories within stories is kind of a part of the comic and then the film. And then they kind of bring that in here too. And but it felt like a Damon Lindelof thing too, especially with the way there's some time travel kind of things that just really reminded me of some Lost episodes. So anyway, I keep saying this, but I may also record an episode about the Watchmen show with someone else who's a big comic nerd, but I didn't know you were so into it. So, wow, there you go. So I'll recommend Watchmen, which is on HBO. And it won all the Emmys this last year. Oh, and the score, I just want to say too, is really great. It's Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross, who I'm just a fan of. But okay, that's enough about Watchmen. Let's talk about this week's movie, Hirokazu Koreeda's The Truth.
I don't remember.
You were just a baby.
And you, Daddy?
No, I've never been here before.
The house looks like a castle.
It does?
Yes, even though there's a prison just behind it.
Vous avez l'habitude, je vais peut-être vous laisser alors.
Non, aucune importance. C'est ma fille avec sa petite famille.
Ah, elle a épousé cet acteur, là.
Oh, acteur, c'est un bien grand mot.
Welcome.
All right, let's talk about The Truth. The Truth is the latest film from Hirokazu Koreeda. Came out just last year in 2019, and it's his first that is not in Japanese. I said in the last episode that it's his first English language film. That's not exactly accurate, because I think most of this is probably in French. I don't know, like 75% or something is in French. It tells a story of a mother and daughter who have kind of a strained relationship. That might be putting it lightly. Very strained relationship. The mother is a famous actress named Fabienne, played by a real-life famous actress, Catherine Deneuve. And the daughter, Lumiere, is played by another big name in French cinema, Juliette Binoche. We also have Ethan Hawke as Lumiere's American husband, Hank. So Fabienne is kind of in her later years, and she's become a bit uncomfortable in her acting career. She's also incredibly critical of everyone around her. Narcissistic to the point that I had flashes of our president actually watching her. I don't know, the way she would have some asides about, I could have thought of that, or I could have done that better. I was like, oh my gosh, narcissism. There it is. But she talks about how, you know, she almost worked with Hitchcock. And there's like all these, she's really big on her own accomplishments, I guess. She also, there's this, a family friend named Sarah that has passed away before the story happened, but her life and her story sort of hangs over these characters. There's like a secret that is not initially revealed about her story. And so that's kind of part of it as well. So Fabienne has just published a memoir. That's the main reason everyone is gathering to kind of celebrate her new book. It's a memoir about her life and the things that some of the things she does include and some of the things she does not include are causing drama with the family. And she's also shooting a film. So that's a big part of the story. So that's kind of the basic setup. So we discussed last time about shoplifters, how Corrier that considers it sort of the end of his second era of filmmaking in his career. And so this is his next film. This would represent the beginning of a third era for him. So my question for you, Amaya, is did you find this significantly different from phase two? Does it feel like a first to you, like something fresh or new, or do you feel a lot of carryover from previous era of Corrieta? What do you think?
Yes and no. Yeah. So yes, I think there's a lot of carryover in the fact that it is about a family. There's a lot of talking, you know. Mm-hmm. I watched a video essay where it talked about one of the lessons, the recurring lessons from his Corrieta's films is that you're able to improve upon yourself and your relationships, particularly with your parents, through the act of talking, mm-hmm. right? Like talking is its own sort of therapy. Where I think it's sort of different is with compared to a lot of the other of the family focused dramas that Corrieta has made. This one was very light and pleasant, even mm-hmm. though it deals with some heavy things.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things that I noticed is the camera work in this film. I think there's more movement. And he talked about working with a cinematographer who was French for this film and him basically, one, insisting on sort of longer takes. Mm-hmm. Like Corrieta thought that there would be more cutting than there actually is in the film. But he talked about, so it sounded like he was talking to doing these longer takes to get more and more of the performance and less setups, I guess. He also just talked about how, like, once he actually got to France and saw just the living space, it's just much bigger than he's used to in Japan. So you can do more things with the camera in terms of movement.
Wow, yeah.
And I think that in the performances, particularly towards the end, there's a scene where they all dance in the street, and he says that would never happen in Japan. You know, so there's also this sort of fantasy element to the film, I think, or at least like this fantastical idea of what maybe Western countries are like, which maybe we'll get into more because there are some things that Corrieta has said that makes me think like, oh, I'm not quite sure he always knows what it's like in various other parts of the world, particularly the West.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I was going to mention the style of it and the camera movement, because I think it does sort of like in Shoplifters, and we kind of talked about last time. So he's made documentaries in the past, and he has sort of a realism style in a lot of his films, at least in Shoplifters. That's kind of how I felt about it. And like almost like shaky cam is not the right word, but it's kind of gritty and down with the people. And I think that's there, but there was also more still shots, I thought, too, of like just shots of nature and different things. And what you mentioned about sort of the lightness of the story. I saw one description of it said it feels like a Corrieta film, but it also feels a lot like a French film. And I think maybe that kind of gets at the same idea that it's a family drama, but it's really light and sweet and pleasant in a way that I think Shoplifters has flashes of that, but then it gets so heavy at the end that it's just a different kind of feeling, I think, in that way. I think there are similarities too. So like in Shoplifters, I always think about the beach scene as kind of the big sweet moment that kind of the memorable scene from it. And I think there's a little bit of a similar thing. And you mentioned it, the dancing scene for me is sort of the sweet family moment that we get here that, you know, was unexpected in a way and kind of, kind of got out of the realm of dialogue and just showed us a moment between a group of people that was really just nice and sweet. And I really liked that part of it. So you mentioned the fact that it's a family drama, like that's a Corrieta touchstone. Did the family drama element of this work well for you?
It did. It kind of took me by surprise because I'm not used to him dealing so much with upper class, like either upper middle class or in this case, based off her home, I would say she's wealthy. Although they always mention that there's a prison in the backyard or behind.
Yeah,
or
something
whatever.
Like that. Mm-hmm. There's a train within hearing distance and that kind of thing. Yeah.
Yeah, but you know, I'm trying to think back at his filmography, and I don't think that he's ever dealt with actors, or at least not. There are people performing roles, but not, you know, paid professional actors and writers and things. And I think that is a different territory from a lot of his other work. And it's interesting because, you know, he was asked about this in an interview, and he said that he didn't really distinguish between the classes. You know, he thought that he was being asked about the relationship between the mother and the daughter. And he was just saying that to his mind, they would have some of the same issues as anyone from a lower class or a higher class, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. That's really interesting. I didn't think about that class difference, but yeah, that absolutely makes a difference to the story. I think the title of the film is interesting, and it kind of the way that plays in the idea of truth and what is truth. And it is sort of a story about filmmaking. And like you mentioned, it's about actors. So there's a lot of like remembered details and misremembered details. There's some focus on like subjective experience. Lumiere, the daughter character, goes into the film studio for the first time in many years. She hasn't been there since she was a kid, I think. And she says it seems different. I think she says it seems bigger or seems smaller. I can't remember. But then her mother says, it's exactly the same. You're the thing that's changed about this, which just kind of gets an interesting thing about the passing of time. It made me think about a movie earlier this year. I'm thinking of Ending Things. Subjective experience was a really big part of that. So I thought that was an interesting connection there. But so the idea of truth is sort of played with a little bit and hinted at in different ways. And then also in the book that she's written, there's, for instance, she writes about sweet mother-daughter moments when Lumiere was a child, and Lumiere reads it and says, that's literally never happened. Like, you're just doing this to sound good. And then also she leaves people out that are really important, and it's, you know, narcissistic and self-serving, the whole book is. But then the sort of that idea of truth, and what is truth, it almost asks like, what is truth? And I think he kind of ends up hinting about art and film in general, or film specifically, sort of like the truth within fiction, I guess. And there's a moment at the end that really plays into that idea that we won't spoil, but it just kind of hints at that. And I think that the filmmaking part of that comes in as well. So the mother, Fabienne, is making this film, and she's kind of struggling on the set as she's aging, and she feels inadequate next to this young actress who's so talented. And the story ends up paralleling her own mother-daughter relationship pretty in a way that's not really on the nose. Like, I didn't think it was too obvious, but it was like clearly that was intended. So I think he's kind of getting at the idea that, you know, there's emotional truth in this fictional sci-fi story that she's filming that can really apply to her life. And maybe it's sort of a case for film as a, you know, therapeutic tool or something like that, in the way that those emotional truths can resonate. So yeah, what did you think about kind of the idea of truth and how it plays into the story?
Yeah, you know, whenever I'm watching a movie, there's a part of me that's always constantly thinking about the title and how it relates. And I think the idea that what the film is really doing, as opposed to like trying to offer you a standard or a specific thing of idea, as opposed to trying to offer you a definitive version of what is true, you know, it's playing with these different perceptions, right, and perspectives that people have. Right, so like one of the running things through the film is with this other character who died before the movie starts. She was really like the surrogate mother, right? Because she was there for lots of different things, and like she was there for the school plays and things. And Lumiere talks about how, you know, she played the Cowardly Lion in Wizard of Oz, and her mother wasn't there. But then later we found out, well, her mother claims that she was there, right? And so it's just these dueling perspectives over what happened. And, you know, the film doesn't get too heavy. There are a couple of scenes that are kind of tense.
Yeah.
They have some arguments, but it never gets too heavy. You know, it always stays sort of playful and has you question things. And there's this more like whimsical element. You know, I was reading this in a review, and it never occurred to me to think. So I'll back up.
Sure.
There's the missing grandfather who was the turtle who then when he shows up, the turtle goes, and when he leaves, the turtle reappears. Right. So there's this fantastical element to the whole film. Like Corietti talked about how he wanted it to be like a fairy tale, like from the perspective of the child. He wanted the story of the film to feel like a fairy tale. And so you had the grandmother as the witch, and then he started thinking about what other fantastical elements you could have. And one of those was like the idea of this animal creature, right? Who becomes her grandfather. And then when he disappears, you know, the turtle reappears. And so it's not clear. I mean, pretty clear that this movie takes place in the real world. And you know, he didn't literally turn into a turtle.
Yeah.
But from the perspective of the child, it's possible. There's magic.
Yeah, I like that, and that plays into the idea of truth too, about, you know, what's literally true and what's, you know, what the daughter's believing. Is there some truth in that that's comforting or fun for her, and maybe a fictional thing can contain truth. There's two different ways you can look at what is true, and I think this movie really wants to play with that idea. Another thing that kind of plays with that idea is Hank's character. This is Ethan Hawke. He mentions over and over that, oh yeah, I wasn't there because I was doing a shoot. I wasn't there because I was doing a shoot. And then we find out later that's not exactly what he was doing. I mean, we can keep that spoiler free as well, but I think it's an interesting dynamic to his character. And his character, so maybe we can talk about the performances. His character's relatively minor in this, but I just really like Ethan Hawke in most things that I've seen him in, and I think he's really good in this, playing this actor who, so he's playing an actor as well, and he kind of wants to, he's not as super successful, I guess, and Catherine Deneuve's character talks about kind of behind his back that he's not a great actor, he's a TV actor or something like that, and kind of makes fun of him, but they end up kind of connecting over acting, and I think that's an interesting dynamic here. But just generally, what did you think of the performances in this?
I like them all. I think most interesting to me is the child performance. Corietta talked about essentially not scripting or not directing the child, and having the actors who work with the child in the scene sort of direct them in the scene, right?
Interesting.
Let me see if I can just find a quote.
You mentioned a little bit of that in the Q&A that I watched.
So this is from Filmmaker Magazine. He's asked about directing children, and he says, as you know, I've directed many children, but I never teach them a script. I always just explain the situation to them when we're filming. With Ethan, I explained to him the kind of emotions or reactions I wanted to elicit from Clementine, and then essentially let him kind of screen, let him be a kind of screen doppelganger as a director. I really left it up to him to kind of direct Clementine while acting his own performance, which I think is a really interesting approach to directing children. Because there's this adage that you hear that you never want to put children or animals in your script, right? Because there are these two things that are sort of unpredictable and sort of hard to control. But I think it's an interesting approach to having like the on-screen parents essentially be responsible for coaxing the performance out of the child on screen.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And that makes sense, because like that kind of follows with what we see in the film, because Ethan Hawke's character is often the one interacting with her, and he's kind of in like fun dad mode for a lot of it. And it feels like he's not really acting, like he's really just playing with these kids. Like he's at the kids' table at a restaurant at one scene, and he's just hamming it up, and they just seems like he's having a lot of fun in like reality. And then he's playing with her in the backyard and that kind of thing too. So yeah, I thought he had a really good performance in this. What about Catherine Deneuve? I mean, we could kind of talk about her legacy a little bit too.
Yeah, so her character does not really, she doesn't really open up, you know, she's, mm-hmm. You know, you call her a narcissist. I think that kind of fits, but where I would not compare her to the current president, it's just that she seems to obviously be very, very, she's obviously very deliberate, you know, about, yeah.
About she's smarter she's than like, him. She's, is that what you're saying?
Yes. Yes. She's like intentionally like projecting an image, right?
It's yeah.
Like, mm-hmm. Like she has in her head a very fixed idea of how actors of a certain status are supposed to behave and treat other people. And so that influences a lot of the way she is, much to her detriment. Mm. And there, you know, there are things that maybe she could have gotten away with when she was younger and ascendant that she can't now that she is essentially at the end of her career. And I think, you know, her character, it's like a version of her, although she says mm-hmm. that she's not like that at all. And she is very self-conscious apparently about having people mistake the character in the film as being what she's actually like.
Yeah.
But you know, she's like this legend of cinema and
yeah.
like there's a movie poster in the film that I forget what it is in the truth, but it's meant to evoke a film that she did called Belle de Jour, which is this really well-known film that she did that also is about sort of fantasy and like a woman sort of acting out these eternal fantasies of desire and things.
Hmm.
I think there are elements of that that I think are that it has that are in, sort of in common with this film.
Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, so she is just a kind of a titan, especially in French cinema. I've seen actually sadly few of her things. She and just French cinema in general is something I've meant to dig way more into. But yeah, Belle de Jour from Louise Buñuel, Umbrellas of Cherbourg, and The Young Girls of Rochefort. Repulsion is a big one. So yeah, she's made a lot of really kind of significant films. And so yeah, having her in this role, I think is, as you mentioned, like very intentional. In the Q&A that I listened to with Corrieta, he said he was literally on a plane and thought, you know, if I could have this actor, and this actor, that would be perfect. And that's who we got was the three leads in this. And yeah, so she is perfect as this aging actress that, yeah, it does in a way parallel her real life. But yeah, as you mentioned, probably only to a point there. But I think her performance is really good. And especially like the scenes of her on set, kind of obviously very uncomfortable and feeling like she has to stick up for herself and that she's inadequate in some way. Like you can feel that compared to the other actors there. But then actually I really like too, something towards the end is that, again, getting at the idea of emotional truth. She has a thing that you hear actors say all the time is that, oh, I should have used that emotion in the scene. But that's sort of a signal of growth at the end of it, I think. But I think that's a good thing. Juliette Binoche as well is the, as we mentioned, is the daughter here. Also a big deal in French cinema. The last thing I saw her in was High Life, the Claire Denis sci-fi thing with Robert Pattinson, which I like pretty well. It's a very different role than this. So it's nice to see her being a nice person again. But then also in Blue from Three Colors Trilogy, which I covered on the podcast last season. That's actually the only things I've seen of her, I think. I'm looking at she's in some other things. Dan in Real Life. That's a fun, sweet movie that is less significant than some of these others. But she's a big deal in French cinema as well. So it's a star-studded cast. But yeah, what's your impression of her in this?
Yeah, you know, she was also really instrumental, I guess, in getting Corrieta to make this film.
He talked about
having her sort of pester him to say like, you got to make a movie in France after Shoplifters. And but yeah, like in this film, her character is so interesting. You know, she's a writer, and I guess she's very good at it because there were a couple of scenes that won't go too much into, but she writes things mm-hmm. that are very effective.
Yeah.
And she also actually, this is actually a sort of a parallel with other Corrieta movies, especially Still Walking. Hmm. So like the plot of Still Walking is that a man who's in a relationship with a woman who's widowed, who has a son, basically takes her to meet his parents. Hmm. And one of the things that you see is just kind of how quickly old roles are reestablished, right? So like you leave your home, you sort of redefine who you are, but then like, you know, you go home and you're around your parents and just like you're and
fall back into again. That. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Or you're not so much a kid as you are a son, right? Like there's a hierarchy that's established. And I feel like when like, so in the beginning of this film, she comes home and there's this pre-existing relationship with her mother and she just really quickly slips right back into that. That role, wow. You know, of those habits, and I like, you know, I love like she has her mother's book because the whole premise of the film is that she comes back because her mother has released this memoir, and she's like just going through it. She stays up all night reading the book and like using these post-it notes to like mark out all the things that she says are mm-hmm. not accurate, which is kind of hilarious.
Yeah.
Well, I'd say like, you know, she also then like immediately because of the way her mother acts, her assistant quits. And so she also easily slips into that role.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Like she's asked to do it. She's told to do it essentially. And then when she does it and it just seems so natural, you know? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. And then there ends up being an interesting thing where she feels like because of the damaged relationship between her and her mother growing up, it kind of held her back from following her own, you know, maybe acting career that she wanted. And then it's also like maybe mom is lying about that. And that's another way she's kind of trying to have the upper hand. So, yeah, I think, again, some things that it's not clear exactly what's true. But, yeah, I think the mother-daughter relationship works really well. And that probably is in large part to the performances there.
This film falls into what I call, it would be like a subset of films that I love. So I have these different lists on Letterboxd. None of them are like that in depth, but like this is, I have this on a list called Process, and they're just films that depict the filming of a movie. So not several movies, you know, it's gotta be a movie that is filmed over the course of a film in some capacity. So like Shadow of the Vampire is on the list. Burden of Dreams, even though it's like, you know, it's a documentary, but it still, it fits. David Mamet's State and Main, 8.5. And so I added this to that list. Pain and Glory is another one that's on the list, or Day for Night. So just movies that somehow feature the process of filmmaking, I think are really interesting.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Is that a public list? Can I share that with people?
I don't. Oh, it's a private list, but I can make it public. There's 10 films on the list. The oddest one and the one that I recommend people seek out if they can, it's on the Criterion Channel, is Symbiopsychotaxiplasm Take One.
I never heard of that before. What a title.
It's the most interesting thing. The premise of the film is that the director, William Greaves, has written a film, and he's got three camera crews, one to shoot the actual scene, one to shoot like a making of documentary, and the third one that documents the whole thing. So there's these three layers of filming that are happening. And then it's kind of like, wait, what is going on here? Because they're just, you see these like different groups of actors shooting the same scenes in Central Park. And then like where it gets really interesting is there's this footage that was shot without his knowledge of the crew, without him talking about the filming of the movie. And at some point they start, it's all, there's this near mutiny where they're just like, this guy doesn't know what he's doing, right? And so they're just sort of trying to just like sort it out amongst themselves.
Is it all scripted?
No.
None of it's scripted. Like it's a documentary essentially about the making of a film. Wow. Okay. I missed that little detail. Wow. Yeah,
It's a documentary about the making of a making of a making. You know, it's just this weird. It's out there. It's great.
Yeah. I was thinking about like Synecdoche, New York, and that's like, they kind of do that within the theater, but of course that's scripted and meant to be really bizarre. And like, so this is like, what if they did that in real life in a movie? Kind of. That sounds fascinating. Yes, I will definitely link to your list if you're cool with that in the show notes, because that sounds like a fun little list. Well, that is Corrieta's The Truth. Thank you so much, Amaya, for being part of season 5. I think it's been a really great season. Looking back at Uncle Boo and Me, Who Can Recall His Past Lives, and then Cemetery of Splendor, The Host, Snowpiercer, Shoplifters, and of course today's The Truth. I think all really great. Could you pick a favorite out of those, Amaya?
if I had to pick one as a favorite, I would probably, I don't know.
They're kind of apples and oranges. It's tough. Yeah.
Yeah. Because it seems like of each pair, I have a favorite. Yeah. Like I still love Cemetery of Splendor, The Host, and Shoplifters. Yeah. But man, no, I can't. I don't think I could pick one.
Yeah, I don't think I could either. I think at the most, like, I feel like I learned the most about like another culture would be Cemetery of Splendor, but an Uncle Boomy as well. But yeah, I do. I think I appreciate Cemetery of Splendor more out of those two. And just such an interesting, fascinating, like the way that sleeping is so involved with that. Yeah, really, really fascinating. But that's not the one that I would just like recommend to just anyone. Whereas The Host, I think I can recommend to just about anyone because it is that kind of big blockbuster action, but it's so thoughtful and so well crafted. And yeah, that The Host is one that I'm shocked I'd never seen before. It's one of the reasons I want to do this podcast at all is to like give myself accountability to watch more things, because I want to watch all these things, but like when do I have the time? And so this helps me to kind of buckle down and do it, and I'm so glad I watched The Host. And then Shoplifters, it was my second time seeing it, but I mean, if I had to name a favorite, it would probably be that. The one that I like think about the most and want to return to the most, that is probably the one for me out of this bunch. But yeah, so there we go. Season 5 is a wrap. Thank you again, Omaya. I think it's been really good. It's been great having you with me.
Oh, yeah. Thank you for having me here. It's just been a pleasure. I just love the opportunity to revisit some of these films, and for some of them, just getting a chance to watch them for the first time and making myself sit down and do it was awesome.
Before we go, I do want to preview a little bit of season 6 of the podcast, since we are closing out season 5 today with this discussion. Season 6, you know, what I try to do is sort of Arthouse Garage talking about arthouse indie classic, try to hit those different kind of buckets of filmmaking and foreign cinema, which is what we've been talking about here. But then what I've done the last couple of years is during awards season, trying to kind of do modern films that are significant this year. And I was thinking, okay, 2020 has been a real crapshoot. Who knows if that we're even going to have award season or what that's going to look like. But actually, it turns out a lot of these award season movies are easier to get to because most of them are streaming. So the plan is to be a longer season, basically from now until the end of the movie season, which is generally speaking the Oscars, which has been pushed back to April. That would make it a much longer season. But the plan is to try to talk through as many of the kind of big 2020 film titles that that we've had this year. So the lineup is not exactly nailed down yet. It may not be nailed down week to week, but we're going to talk about as many of this year's kind of big films as we can. So I mentioned Dick Johnson is Dead. That's going to be coming up. The Assistant, The Way I See It. I know I'm going to talk about Nomadland. And hopefully Mank, the David Fincher Mankiewicz biopic that's about Citizen Kane, and have back my guest from the Citizen Kane episode, who knows people in the Mankiewicz family, Rance Collins. So that should be a really interesting discussion. That's been pushed back to December, I think, because the film is going to be released in December now. So that's the other thing, is watching the calendar on this, because of 2020, so many things have been pushed back or pulled or, you know, canceled entirely. So we'll see. But the plan is to talk about 2020 films and kind of look at the best of the year. So I'm really excited to do that. Going to have a lot of different guests. Omaya will be back for at least one or two of these, and several other people that I've been able to meet recently in the Arkansas film scene. So yes, I'm excited. That's going to be season 6. Are you excited, Omaya?
I am super excited.
Right answer. Thank you. All right. Well, with that tease out of the way, then I guess we can wrap up this episode. Thank you so much for listening to Arthouse Garage. If you would like to support the show, you can leave a rating or review on iTunes or whatever podcast app you're using. You can also buy a t-shirt or some merch from arthousegarage.com/shop. We have shirts that say movies are for everyone, and one that says watch old movies. That's really cool. So you can go check those out. And also you can follow on social media. We are at Arthouse Garage on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, Letterboxd. You can find us there. And if you want to email me directly, it's andrew@arthousegarage.com, or subscribe to our email newsletter, which you can go to arthousegarage.com/subscribe. All right, that will do it for this episode. Thank you so much again for listening. And until next time, keep it snob free.